love was like a supernova in the nebula of my soul.
Okay, anytime we're going to have a guest on this show, Ian and I have a discussion about what can we use as the bumper music before we bring them on.
Is like a big black hole.
So today we talked about, since Neil deGrasse Tyson's on the show, what do we use? She Blinded Me with Science or Space Oddity? No, those are played out. And so Ian went on to YouTube and found, Neil, what the hell was that?
I don't know where you guys dug that up. I thought I had buried that long ago.
What was it?
Wow.
So, okay, so I for a few years I hosted the spinoff of PBS Nova called Nova Science Now. And one of the episodes, one of my favorite actually, is when we went to explore the people behind the music where they fix your notes.
Auto-tune.
So the guy who programmed Auto-tune, the guy who invented it, we went and talked with him. And the question is, does it fix anything? And can you fix it in real time rather than later in post? And so one of the producers wrote a song for me to sing, and I'm not a singer except in the shower. And that one is after it had been auto-tuned, and I'm glad you picked that version and not the one before.
Well, so what, as a scientist, what conclusion did you come to after listening to that, Neil?
So after extensive analysis, I realized I could not sing. That was the conclusion.
And auto-tune can't make you sing.
Yeah, auto-tune had tried. And by the way, what we generally say or think of as auto-tune, where the voice gets a little weirdly electric,
yeah,
that is an artifact that is the consequence of changing the frequency too quickly. And that was never supposed to be there. But then people found it in the software and then did it on purpose.
Mm.
And the guy was shocked that this is how people were doing it. Because when auto-tune is used perfectly, you don't even know. It's just the perfect note coming out of the singer who happened to be flat or whatever in a particular note for the particular song.
Mm-hmm.
So most things today are auto-tuned, and you don't even know it.
Well, I'm glad Ian found that so we can get a little science lesson on auto-tune here today.
That's awesome.
I should say, for those of you who don't know, Neil deGrasse Tyson is, I don't think there's any doubt about this, America's modern-day science educator. He, of course, did the Cosmos series on Fox a few years ago. You see him on all sorts of TV talk shows. He has Star Talk, which is a podcast radio TV series. And he has a new book, which I have to tell you, Neil, I am thrilled. You're the first author I've had on in a long time who doesn't have a colon in the title of their book.
Ooh, I thank you for noticing that, because I hate colons. Thank you.
You're welcome. The book is called Astrophysics for People in a Hurry, and it is the sort of thing you will read and try to figure out what it means and then have to reread again. But when you're done all of that, you will understand a lot more about our universe, which is what your intention was, right?
Yeah, because what I noticed was that many people, busy people, people with like full days with kids or job or school, whatever, that you've seen a headline come down the pipe. And there are words there that you're not quite fluent in, but they definitely piqued your interest, like exoplanet or dark energy or multiverse. And you've seen this. And what I've tried to do was collect these ideas together in a way that will enable you, empower you, to sort of consummate your relationship with the cosmos. And that way you will become fluent in all these topics, so that the next morning at the water cooler, you're like right there for whatever might be the next headline that comes across.
Oh, I'm going to have to read your book, because my girlfriend's son is going for his doctor's degree in physics, and he's a science and a physics and a math teacher right now in high school, but I have a tough time talking to him sometimes.
Oh, well, you just read this book and it'll be fine. You'll be fine.
Okay, great.
I want to read something from your book here, Neil. Before I read it, I want to say this is another reason I love science. I dictated this sentence from your book into my laptop today, and its voice recognition software got every word right.
Whoa.
Yay, science.
Nice.
So you wrote regarding dark matter, quote, "What we know is that the matter we have come to love in the universe, the stuff of stars, planets, and life, is only a light frosting on the cosmic cake, modest buoys afloat in a vast cosmic ocean of something that looks like nothing. That's very poetic.
But it has the advantage of being precisely accurate.
So. Now, when you say we are afloat in a vast cosmic ocean of something that looks like nothing, how do we know what that nothing is, and why did we decide to call it dark matter?
So you're asking, how do we know there's nothing there?
Yeah.
So dark matter, I think, is an unfortunate name for it. The history of that that label is clear and present, but so here's what happened. We looked around the universe, and you can add up all the stars and galaxies and all the matter that we've known and loved, including black holes and dark clouds and everything else, and it only comes to about 1/6 of the total gravity that we see operating in the universe. So something is making 85%, that's about 5/6, 85% of the gravity of the universe has no known origin, yet we measure it. And so here's this thing operating, but we can't see it. It doesn't show up in our telescopes. It doesn't interact with light. And so it is this ocean of nothing whose presence is unmistakable. No, I shouldn't call it nothing. It's whatever it is, it's a thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not anything we can interact with, and it is the longest unsolved problem in modern astrophysics. And maybe in all of science. It was discovered, the problem, this discrepancy was discovered in the 1930s. So this has been looming over our heads for the last 80 years.
Is it safe to say that this is what's filling the spaces between galaxies?
There is space between galaxies, but what has happened is dark matter, what we're calling dark matter, we can see where its gravity influences, and in the centers of huge areas of dark matter is where we find galaxies. So ordinary matter drifted to the middle of these concentrations of dark matter, and that's where we find our matter. So it's not so much that it's filling the space between the galaxies, it is responsible for where the galaxies formed in the first place.
Wow.
And by the way, it really should have been called dark gravity, because that's literally what it is. It's gravity, and we don't know where it comes from. Because dark matter implies that it might be matter, but since we don't know what it is, we have no right to even put that word in the term that we're using to describe it. And I joke, and I say, since we really don't know anything about it, we should just call it Fred. Just so that it leaves you with no bias about how to think about what it is we're trying to solve.
You know, there's this very odd phenomenon in the sky in Canada. I was talking about this on the show last week. It's not part of the Aurora Borealis. Scientists have not been able to figure out what it is, but they've decided to call it Steve.
No.
Seriously.
Thank you.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
I like that. Plus, it's over Canada, so, you know, anything can happen over Canada.
If
you don't know what it is, and you can't, and you have a hard time describing it, give it a name that doesn't force any kind of bias, and that will help attract ideas that could solve the problem.
Okay, while we're talking about the sky, you are the director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. That's your full daytime job.
In addition
to the writing and speaking that you do all over the place. And I actually read that you first saw the sky, what it really looked like inside that planetarium when you were 9 years old, and now you're the director of that. And I don't want to dig too much into that story. What I'm curious about is the projector that's at the center of that and every other planetarium that puts the sky on the domed ceiling of that planetarium. In your lifetime, how many times have they had to change that projector because the sky looks different or we've discovered new things up there?
So the sky, just to be clear, the sky as put up by the projector is, so this is the traditional, what we call optical projector, is just the stars of the night sky, and they're there, and they, these stars are moving through space, but so slowly that in your lifetime that you would not notice it.
Okay.
So the fact is, no, they don't. That has not had to change. It is the night sky that we are sharing, communing through time with the ancients who first saw it and put their mythologies up on the sky. you know, I want to one day redo all the constellations. I think it's time for an upgrade. You know, I'd like have like the cell phone constellation or the smartphone or the Prius or something. Stuff that matters to us.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
But anyhow, so no, it's the same star. So here's where it matters. So watch what happens. Modern planetariums don't even use an optical projector. They have that puts purely stars on the dome. They have projectors connected to a computer. And now you can put up any data set at all. And you're not even limited to the universe. You can go inside a volcano, inside the Earth, inside of an atom. Or you can put up the stars of the night sky from Earth, then go to Pluto and see what things look like from there. Excuse me, Pluto's not a planet anymore. Go to Neptune, see what the sky looks like from there. Go across the galaxy and even across the universe. And since it's a data set, you can update that data set as necessary. And so in my place, the Hayden Planetarium, I have someone whose title is Director of... Director of the Digital Universe, okay? And that's just cool. Yes. I always wanted that on my business card, but he's got it. And as new data come in, he then puts it into this he loads it up. And monthly, we give public sessions, public events, where we take you through the latest data available on the universe. So it is always a continuous work in progress.
Recently, Stephen Hawking said in recording a new documentary that's going to air on the BBC this summer that humanity needs to become a multi-planetary species within the next century in order to avoid extinction. Do you agree with him, and when are you leaving?
Yeah, I'm not authorized to do that. That declaration makes a good headline, and you think about it, you say, yeah, that kind of makes sense, but... I'm a contrarian there for the following reason. First of all, so what are we worried about? We're worried about an asteroid running around extinct that took out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. I get that. We might be worried about a virus that we can't control. We might be worried that we'll trash Earth and we need another planet to live on. Or some other, you know, okay, I get that. But let's think of this practically, all right? If we're going to colonize another planet, it would basically have to be Mars, because you're not going to Venus. It's 900 degrees Fahrenheit. So you go to Mars. Now, are you living in a bubble, or are you going to terraform Mars so that it's like Earth, and then you actually can live and work and do things? So I'm thinking you'd want to terraform it if you want to claim that you have colonized two planets. And terraform, great new word of the decade, where you... take whatever it is, seed it with microbes and whatever else, so that oxygen gets generated, you introduce plant life, and then ultimately animal life, and then it's self-sustaining. Fine. Well, watch this. So, Stephen Hawking says, let's be a two-planet species. So how are we going to do that? We're going to first terraform Mars, then ship a billion people there. Now, here's what I'm saying. I think it's easier to deflect an asteroid that might render you extinct than to terraform Mars and ship a billion people there.
You think?
I think it's easier to... And think of it. If you have the power to terraform Mars, you have the power to turn a trashed Earth back into Earth again.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So everything that you can think of, every reason you can give for putting people on Mars out of fear of what happened to Earth, whatever that investment is, it's got to be less to just fix the Earth and protect us from asteroids and find a super virus serum that no one ever gets a virus anymore. That's got to be easier. And not only that, suppose you do go two species, and there is something that's going to render one planet extinct. Do you just sit there and watch? Goodbye, 5 billion people, or 10 billion. Is that what you're really going to do?
Yeah.
So I don't see it as a practical pathway to what I think people will actually do will not be what he thinks is necessary. That's all.
See, unlike you, Neil, I have been going into space since the 1970s, because that's when I started my broadcast radio career, and my voice has been traveling through space and maybe through that dark matter you were talking about for over four decades.
Oh, so your radio bubble with your voice is now 40 light years in radius.
Yes.
So that would have washed over, I've got to check my numbers, certainly several dozen exoplanets.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't heard all of your broadcasts, so I don't know how good an emissary you are for all, for the rest of us.
Well, it's not a matter of how good I am now. It's how good I was in the 70s.
Oh.
And that's what I worry about. If aliens do have some method of receiving our radio and television signals from the 1970s, they're never coming here once they see what we were wearing.
But I can tell you. I can tell you.
Okay. And what I thought about just recently is if from the 70s and late 60s, you also get the broadcast of I Dream a Genie and Bewitched.
Oh, yeah.
And they're wondering, uh-oh, these people have serious powers.
And Paul's had plenty of broadcasts that have gone into the black holes.
So. Oh, yes. They yeah. aimed for the black holes.
Yes. Thank you very much. Neil, I have a question for you from my daughter, who's a big fan of yours. She wants to know how we get more young women into STEM careers.
Yeah, I don't have a silver bullet there to fix that. What I do know is that these let's back up. There are professions that changed mightily from the 1970s when the modern women's lib movement kicked in and women joined the workforce in huge numbers. And you've seen tremendous gains, especially in places where you would have not expected to have changed quickly, if at all, like medical doctors. You know, just think about the profession of medical doctors throughout all of time. It was like men, right? It was a man thing.
Yep.
Now it's basically 50-50. Veterinary medicine is like a high 80s% women relative to men. So there are places that have scientific basis where great gains have been made. There are others where that is not the case. And we're still trying to understand and analyze why that is so. Is it because the men are just, you know, the men are misogynist and sexist and that, but then you'd have to explain why men in some fields are more sexist than men in other fields, right? So I think this problem is not fully resolved. But what is clear is that there are forces that can be unwelcoming if you do not represent the majority who's there in charge. And I felt that myself coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And so as long as those forces are there, people who could become brilliant scientists coming down the pipe, if they don't happen to have the tenacity to fight, you know, sexist, pig-headed men, and they'll say, I don't have the energy for this, I'm going into another profession, then we will lose potential brilliant minds as we go forward. So you want to have no barriers, no social cultural barriers. Only then can you assert that this is the mix of what is natural and however people divide out. But until that happens, there's nothing you can say. It's straighten up, fly right, or, you know, get out of town.
Yep. Although I think that'll change demographically, because people in their teens, 20s, early 30s, thanks to people like you and Bill Nye, the science guy, and before you, Carl Sagan, they have had an education in science through the popular media and through social media that other generations before them didn't have. And as the older stalwarts of science move on and take their whatever you want to call that kind of prejudice with them, the younger demographics will age into it and hopefully balance things out.
Right. So that is exactly. So now there's something called the leaky pipeline, where a next generation comes in, but then they don't stay in.
Yeah.
And but you're right. There's always some old guard that can't see things differently, and they're kind of stuck in their ways. Even if in their own day they would have been considered sort of a liberal mind, a socially liberal mind, you can become ossified and don't keep moving with the trends. And if you don't, you know, you just sort of, you're right. You said it politely, but really just have to wait till they all die. I'll say it. I said it.
Before we go, Neil, Dan Strauss, the producer of this show, is in a band.
Yes.
Which he called the Seventh Planet.
Yes, Seventh Planet Band.
I told him that you would have some information about Uranus, our seventh planet, to share with him, particularly particularly because of Cassini and its run coming to an end now, right?
Yeah, so Cassini is not around Uranus, which is how you pronounce that, unless, like, you're 8 years old or something.
It is? No. No, wait a minute. I've always heard it was Uranus.
Yeah, because you were in elementary school when you heard that. That's why.
Well, I'm still my brain.
Are
is
you
still
arguing with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson?
My brain
so
is still
Uranus. It comes from the Greek. You look at the Greek letters that spell it as Ouranus, And there's no way you get Uranus out of that. It's Uranus.
Oh, well, crap.
Yeah.
We do.
Okay. So that's A. B, if you're going to say seventh planet, this may be a little more information than you asked for.
Uh-oh.
But if you want to use the word seven and the word planet, that's very classical. If you go back to ancient Greece, they looked up at the sky and they found seven objects that moved against the background stars. Seven. And those seven objects, which each had a name, became built into the names we give to the 7 days of the week. And those seven planets, and by the way, in Greek, the word for wanderer, which is what they called these things, is planetes. So you count them up. So what were the seven wanderers as seen from Earth? Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, the Sun, and the Moon. Those were the seven classical planets. And that was the last time the word planet had an unambiguous definition to it. And you move forward 1,000, 1,500 years, and you get Copernicus saying, oh, we are not in the center of all things, the sun is, and we are just one like the rest of these other objects orbiting the sun. And so that, and then the word planet had to take on different meaning. And planet, then, if you orbit the sun, you're a planet. Oh, but the moon orbits Earth. So that's not a planet. So all this got shaken up. But we had already embedded those seven names into the 7 days of the week. That's how you get Moon Day. That's Monday. And Sunday. And Saturn's Day. That's Saturn. That's Saturday. So if you're going to use the word seven, be ready to bring in a little confusion there because of the history of that number as associated with the word planet.
I expect to hear that brought into every cover song you do with the band from now on.
Wait a minute. Are you saying we have to change the name of our band?
No,
you
can.
The name of your band would be cooler if it was The Seven Planets.
The Seven Planets?
Yes. And then it's like, ooh, what do you mean by that? Isn't there eight planets or nine? No, there's seven, according to the Greeks.
Neil deGrasse Tyson's new book is called Astrophysics for People in a Hurry. And I'm looking forward to seeing you when you come to St. Louis on May 18th at the Peabody. I was there a few years ago when you appeared, and it really warmed my heart to see more than 3,000 people staying for the 3 hours that you stood on stage to have a scientist explain things to them and then get a standing ovation.
Yeah, that still was a little crazy for me that even happened that way.
it's going to happen again on the 18th.
I'll try to do it again, but yeah, it's just stunning. It's a statement of untapped curiosity that I think, or hunger pains for knowledge that I think lurks within everyone's belly, and I'm delighted and honored to be in the capacity to deliver that to whoever wants to listen.
Hey, Neil, we would be honored if you went on and liked our Facebook page. Seventh Planet Band on Facebook.
I'm sure that's what he's going to do right after this interview. Neil deGrasse Tyson, you're a hero and America's favorite science educator, and it's been an absolute honor to speak with you today.
Thank you. And one quick note, I think that at that theater, the first 2,000 people who bought tickets
get your
a free book.
Yeah, that's right. That's brilliant. I got to go, Neil. Thanks for being on today.
All right, thanks for having me on.